Hello and welcome to our second podcast on the ISB's Conceptual Framework Project. My name is Rachel Nubley and I'm a member of the staff here at the ISB. I'm joined today by Stephen Cooper, an ISB board member, and Peter Clark, Director of Research here at the ISB. During the January 2013 board meeting, the ISB held education sessions on the definitions of assets and liabilities and presentation. In particular, the difficult question of what should be presented in other comprehensive income. As these were education sessions, no decisions were made. The purpose of this podcast is to provide an overview of the discussions at the January 2013 board meeting. Peter, could we start with definition of an asset, and could you provide us with an overview of what was covered in the session on definition of an asset?
Yes, thanks, Rachel. Perhaps I could start by repeating the existing definition of an asset, which is a resource controlled by the entity as a result of past events from which future economic benefits are expected to flow to the entity. Now, basically, that definition isn't too bad, and in fact, we plan to stick with something pretty much like the existing definition in the sense that it will refer to a resource. But there are some areas that we feel do need some clarification. If I could start with the last part of that, really, future economic benefits are expected to flow to the entity. I think that causes two problems. The first is that the reference to future economic benefits has sometimes led people to confuse the resource with the economic benefits that the resource is capable of generating. The board has clearly taken the position over the last few years that the asset is the resource, it's not the future economic benefits. But including the reference to economic benefits in the definition does risk causing confusion sometimes. And that's possibly made worse by the reference to expected, which people are often tempted to interpret as a sort of probability threshold. And I think that causes a couple of problems again. One problem is I think it does heighten the possible confusion between the resource and the benefits. And secondly, it also causes some confusion with the recognition criteria, which talk about economic benefits being probable. And so I think it's not clear to readers what the interaction is between expected and probable. The way we think we should deal with that is, in fact, to make it clearer that the asset definition, or the asset, is the resource, not the benefits, and that the reference to expectation really is unhelpful. Because it does appear to imply a probability threshold to some people. And so what we think we should do is we should remove the reference to expected from the definition of an asset. We think the notion that the benefits are not certain is important, and so we plan to keep the replace the word expected with the notion that the benefits, that the resource should be capable of generating benefits, so not that the benefits are certain or virtually certain or probable or more likely than not or expected, whatever expected means, but the resource is capable of generating benefits. In other words, there are at least some outcomes where the resource will generate some benefits. There may be some outcomes where it doesn't generate benefits. Perhaps a good example is an option, a purchased option. If an entity holds an option, its asset is the option. It's not the asset that it will receive if it exercises the option, but it's the option. That's the existing resource that it controls today. There are a couple of other aspects of the definition which I think are less problematic, but we may be able to streamline it and make it slightly clearer for people, although I think the things I'm about to cover aren't really fundamental changes. I mentioned that the definition talks about past events, and there's nothing really wrong with that. But we think that referring to past events is neither sufficient, because the fact that there was a past event doesn't mean you necessarily still have the asset at the reporting date. You still have to check whether you have the asset at the reporting date. And secondly, it's not really necessary. What's really important is to establish whether you have the asset at the reporting date. It doesn't necessarily matter how you acquired it, at least not in terms of identifying whether an asset exists. So we think it would be a good idea to remove the reference to past event from the definition. We would, however, have the notion that the resource is a present resource. It's one that exists at the reporting date. Another thing we're thinking of doing is moving the reference to control from the definition of an asset into the recognition criteria. We don't actually think that will cause any change in practice, but we think it may be slightly more understandable because it's separating the question of does an asset exist from whose asset is it. Control will deal with whose asset is it. Overall, the definition we're thinking of proposing is that an asset is a present economic resource, and then we would add a new definition of an economic resource, which would say that it's a scarce item that's capable of generating economic benefits.
Thank you, Peter. Stephen, could you summarise for us the discussions that the board had about the revised definition of an asset and what was proposed by the staff?
Okay, thanks, Rachel. Yes, we had an interesting discussion about it. Of course, we made no decisions at this meeting. We'll continue with that discussion next month and then on through the issuance of the discussion paper. I think there were some board members that were concerned in this area about whether we should really make any change at all, because I think they felt that if it's not fundamentally broken, then why change it? But I think many, however, did recognise that there are some issues to do with the definition, as Peter outlined. Confusion, particularly about the word expected, and some of the other difficulties that he highlighted. I think some perhaps would have wanted to retain past events, feeling that does it really make that much difference, and should we really sort of just remove it for the sake of it? There was certainly some support for the idea of treating control as part of the recognition criterion, but again, we didn't take any votes on that. One area that we did have some discussion on was whether a physical asset could be subdivided. This, of course, relates to our leasing project with the whole idea of a right of use asset. So we had some discussion on that. So we've got some way to go in terms of finalising this, but I think we made useful progress on understanding what the issues are that we need to deal with in this particular area.
Thank you. I'd like now to move on to the discussion the board had about the definition of a liability. Peter, could you again provide us with an overview of the problems associated with the existing liability definition and how those problems could be addressed?
Yes, thanks, Rachel. And I should start again by saying that the basic definition, we think, is more or less okay, in the sense that it's referring to an obligation that is expected to generate economic outflows of economic benefits. But again, I think there are one or two areas that we can tighten up. The first is that, like the definition of an asset, it does have that expected criterion and it does have the reference to economic benefits. And that causes the same problems that it causes in the definition of an asset. Then we looked at some areas which would not involve changes to the definition per se, but might involve some better guidance on what the definition means in certain cases. And perhaps I can highlight three aspects of that. The first is what happens if there is an obligation that in some way is conditional on future events. And I think there are two categories of those. First of all, there are events that are completely outside the control of the entity itself. So that might be something like a change in an index, or it might be whether some loss occurs. And the notion we have there is, again, that we need to separate clearly the obligation from the future benefits that may flow from the obligation, or the outflows of benefits that may arise because of the obligation. And so again, to take the example of an option, if an entity has written an option, it doesn't know whether it will have to pay, but it does have an obligation to pay if the conditions in the option are satisfied. One notion that sometimes be used to describe that kind of obligation is a stand ready obligation. The entity's obligation is to stand ready to pay if some specified event occurs. And again, the types of liability we're talking about there could be things like warranties, you'll have to pay if the goods turn out to be defective. Could be an option, you'll have to pay if the counterparty chooses to exercise. Could be an insurance contract, you'll have to pay if the insured event occurs. So again, the liability there is the obligation to stand ready to pay if the event occurs. It's not the actual outflow that will occur once you know that the event has occurred. Second class of conditional obligations is ones that are conditional in some way on whether the entity takes some action. These are more difficult, and in fact we're still really doing some more work on these. These have generated some issues, for example, that the Interpretations Committee has been looking at. There's an issue that's going through at the moment on levies, where one of the questions is whether an obligation arises before the triggering date for a levy. And I think those issues are more difficult to deal with in some ways, because on the one hand, it seems as though the entity can avoid the obligation by taking some action or refraining from taking some action. On the other hand, it may sometimes seem quite unrealistic for the entity actually to take that action. And people also question how that interacts with the notion that an entity is presumed to be a going concern. So as I said, that part of the guidance we're still really considering. Another area where we're considering guidance is on constructive obligation. And the framework already acknowledges the notion of a constructive obligation, not exactly in those words, but the concept is there in the framework already. And it is applied in the provision standard IS 37. And I think the difficulty there is pinning down exactly what a constructive obligation is. And there's sometimes a feeling that maybe people would like more guidance on how to distinguish constructive obligations, which are considered to be real obligations, versus something that just arises from economic compulsion, something that an entity will almost certainly do because economic circumstances dictate that, but that's maybe hard to argue is really a result of an obligation. That can be quite a difficult boundary to draw, and so we'll consider whether there's whether it's possible to improve on the existing guidance on that. Now, the final area I wanted to highlight is what we might call obligations to stand aside. It's where an entity says that it will not do something, and if it does do that thing, it will incur some loss. So an example that's sometimes cited is a non-compete agreement, when an entity says that it won't compete with some other business, perhaps as a result of an agreement during a business combination. And the question is, does that obligation or requirement not to compete, does that constitute an obligation that's a liability, or is it something else, for example, an impairment of a recognised or unrecognised asset? That again is quite a difficult issue. It's a slightly marginal issue in some ways as well. It's not the most common type of obligation, but it's one that we do plan to have a look at. And so the proposed definition that we're looking at the moment is that a liability is a present obligation to transfer an economic resource. So it's streamlined a bit from the existing definition. We've taken out the reference to economic benefits. We've taken out the reference to expected. And similarly, the notion of past events is replaced by the requirement for it to be a present obligation. And we're using the same term, economic resource, that I mentioned in relation to the definition of an asset. And I think that keeps quite clearly the parallel with the definition of an asset.
Thank you, Peter. Stephen, again, could I ask you to summarise for us the Board's discussions of the liability definition?
Well, Rachel, I guess they were quite similar to the discussions we had on the asset side. A lot of interest in the potentially new definition, a lot of discussion around it, but again, no decisions taken. I think, however, the Board recognised that this is an area which is more difficult, perhaps, than the asset side, not least because there are so many interactions with standards level projects, many of which we have on our agenda at the moment. So Peter mentioned levies, which is currently active with the Interpretations Committee, but there's also regulated accounting, emission rights, there's the whole liabilities equity debate about and the boundary between the two. And then there are other areas where the Board has looked at some years ago, IS 37 and some issues to do with that. And then wider issues to do with unvested employee benefits, pension, share-based payments. So there's so many difficult areas which are largely related to liability definition, but also related issue of liability measurement. I think there was certainly support for the approach that Peter said about obligations which are conditional on an event outside the entity's control. More discussion, though, on the obligations that the entity could potentially avoid, and the levies is a good example of that. No decisions taken on that, but that's something I think we'll come back to and spend a lot more time on in the next few weeks.
Thank you. Finally, the board discussed the very difficult issue of what should be presented in other comprehensive income, or OCI. Steve, can you explain why the board is discussing the issue of OCI?
Well, OCI and the related problems of measuring profit, income, performance is something that really the current framework doesn't deal with in any detail. Of course, we have OCI, the board uses OCI, but unfortunately there's no real conceptual basis for how to distinguish items that are presented in OCI versus those which are presented as part of profit or loss. Related to that is the issue of recycling or reclassification, whether items which are initially recognised in OCI should be subsequently recognised in profit or loss based upon some event like realisation of an unrealised gain. And at the moment we have some items which are recycled and other items which are not. So very much the framework is deficient in this area, in the sense that we have very little guidance about OCI and recycling. Also, when we did the agenda consultation, this was an area that was identified by many respondents as being of particular high priority, that at the moment we're standard setting on a case-by-case basis and not really perhaps having that underlying conceptual foundation on which to base standards level decisions. So, as I say, very much a high priority for the board.
Thank you. Peter, could you describe how the staff have approached the OCI issue?
Yes, of course. I think the first starting point, in a way, is that many people have told us that they found the notion of some sort of total or subtotal, which is currently labelled profit or loss, to be a useful total. So it seems useful to try and work with that. And the question, of course, is how to distinguish the things that are included in profit or loss from the things that are included in OCI, or what we call OCI today. The staff started off by trying to look for a conceptual basis, a clean conceptual basis for distinguishing profit or loss from OCI. And various suggestions have been made over the years, for example, realised versus unrealised, or core versus non-core. And several of these distinctions have been suggested. They often overlap, so quite often items that are identified by one will be identified by another, but they don't overlap entirely, and none of them really seems to fit exactly with all the cases where OCI has been used or with cases where people seem to suggest it. So it looked as though one single clean definition like that isn't going to do the job by itself. We then looked at what's currently in OCI based on our existing standards and exposure drafts to see if we could identify the common themes. And of course, some of the themes were ones that coincided with some of the suggested classifications I've just mentioned. But one thing we found useful was to look at the items currently in OCI in three different categories. First of all, we identified a set of uses of OCI where what the board is doing is actually providing two different measurements of items. One item, usually a current type measurement, is being used for the measurement in the statement of financial position, the balance sheet, and a different measurement, usually a cost-based measurement or a sort of non-current measurement, is being used to for inclusion in profit or loss. And then under that approach, what's included in OCI forms a sort of bridge between the two different measurements. In that category, it seems natural really that you would recycle if the objective is to provide one measurement basis for use in profit or loss and a different measurement in OCI, then the only way to really achieve that is if you do recycle at some point from OCI. Second category we identified were ones that seem to be in OCI because they're only capturing really some part of the economics of the transaction. And we identified two that seem to fall into that category. One is cash flow hedging, where the debits or credits to OCI stay there until the hedge transaction hits profit or loss. So the notion there seemed to be that one side of the transaction is measured currently, and the other side will only be reported at a later date. And again, clearly recycling seems to be a requirement of that third category, of that group of uses of OCI. The other item we identified that seems to be in that category is cumulative translation adjustments on foreign subsidiaries. And again, the rationale for that seems to be that although the measurement in the financial statements captures the effect of foreign exchange on the recognised assets and liabilities, to some extent it's an incomplete picture. It doesn't capture the full economic effect of the currency movements on the entity, because obviously that's not capturing the full value of the subsidiary. And then the third category we identified, in a way, isn't a category at all. It's the residual of everything else, where it seemed that for some reason the board had wanted to highlight particular types of transaction, but had accounted for them in ways that don't involve recycling. And so that's things like revaluation of property, plants and equipment. It's things like the treatment of own credit in liabilities when an entity uses the fair value option. And there are three or four that we identified in this bucket. Now, I should stress that having grouped these types of existing use of OCI into these three buckets, we weren't trying to make a statement about whether it's appropriate for them to be in each of those buckets. We were just cataloguing, really, what's been done in the past. But we did find that as a useful tool for analysis to think about how to move forward with the analysis of how to distinguish OCI from items in OCI from items in profit or loss, and also to think about the recycling issue. And we'll be taking those thoughts forward as we develop this work.
Thank you, Peter. Stephen, could you summarise the discussion on the OCI issue, please?
Yeah, a lively discussion on this, as you would expect. I think some had some concern that by providing these three categories, in some way we were seeking to justify what we have at the moment. I don't think that is the case, and I think most of the board were very much sort of pleased to see this analysis of what we have now as a sort of maybe a starting point to really thinking about OCI and how we should deal with it. There certainly wasn't any support for removing profit or loss or going to a single statement. I know that this has been something that many people feel the board has some secret agenda on, but that's not the case, certainly from the discussion that we had. And as Peter said, there is general support for retaining some notion of profit and loss in OCI. Whether it's exactly what we have at the moment remains to be seen. But certainly, I think most people feel that we do need to disaggregate and provide subtotals, and that profit or loss is a widely used measure and should be retained. We had a good discussion about the three categories that Peter mentioned, and related to that, of course, OCI. So I think people felt that type of analysis was useful. However, I think a lot of the board were really concerned that we should have some sort of conceptual basis for this, and they wanted the staff to go away and do more work on really what is it that distinguishes profit and loss from OCI. But as Peter said, that's a challenge, and you can come up with different approaches like core and non-core and realised and unrealised, but none of them sort of seem to work perfectly by themselves and don't really sort of appear to be satisfactory. So, as I say, staff's going to do more work on how we might go about that and what we might do at a standards level to deal with some of these issues. So we've got some way to go, but I think we had a useful initial conversation facilitated by the classification of the OCI items that we have at the moment.
Thank you, Stephen. Peter, could you outline for us what the next steps are in the Conceptual Framework Project?
Yes. First of all, we plan to bring a working draft of most sections of the discussion paper to the board to discuss at the February board meeting. And in that discussion, we plan to get the board's views on many of the issues discussed in that draft. I should stress that it is very much a working draft, and that it will, of course, be available on our website as board papers for that meeting. But clearly, at that stage, it won't have had the input from the board, and so it should be seen just as really a staff working draft at this stage. Clearly, we won't get through everything in February, and so we'll have some issues to bring back in March and April. But our plan is to move ahead reasonably promptly with this. We're aiming to publish a discussion paper at the end of the second quarter, and then to go out and talk to people about the discussion paper and get views back from people.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both Stephen and to Peter. This concludes our podcast on the January education sessions. Thank you very much for listening.